friends. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. And again, thank you for joining me. I guess I say that every single show, don't I? But I do mean it. It's not perfunctory. I know your time is valuable. And like they always say on the airlines when you're landing, I know you have other flying options. Glad you chose us. Well, I feel the same way about this show. Lots of options out there and good ones, too. But I'm glad that you're part of our listening, what would you call it, community, maybe. The Stand to Reason community. And glad to give you a piece of my mind today, as far as I'm able. Oh, had a little discussion with Amy during STR Ask about answering questions. And I said, well, wait a minute, we just respond to questions. Whether we answer them or not is another issue. So we'll see about that. By the way, quick update here. You know that, let's see, Rethink Dallas is coming up February. I mean, it seems so far ahead a couple of months ago, and now it's just on top of us, it feels. I mean, February 28th, actually, and 29th, that's still over a month away, but a lot of time to plan, and we're already taking pre-signups. You know, we got over 800 people that signed up in that magical pre-signup period where you can save 10 bucks or whatever it is. We're past that period now, but you still can save, I think, a few bucks by signing up before the event itself. Just want to let you know about that. We've got a great team that's going to be out there at Cottonwood Creek Church talking about false ideas about God. That is rethinking your false ideas about God. We did that whole routine, let's see, in November in Minneapolis to, what, 2,400. First time out, 2,400 young folk and group leaders. So I'm extending the invitation. You know what Rethink's all about. All Friday night, all day Saturday, intensive fun and education geared for young people. That would be junior high or high school, but we're not checking IDs at the door. Anyone can come. And we're giving it our best shot. Our whole team is going to be part of that enterprise. Tim Barnett, Alan Schliemann, Amy Hall, Jonathan Noyes, me. And is Jay Warner Wallace on board with us, or is that Frank Turek coming up in, I don't know. Okay, one of those guys. Actually, more than just those guys. I think it's Jim. Jay Warner Wallace will be on board with us in Dallas. I saw his picture on the brochure. Think so. And anyway, it's going to be grand lineup and great, great teaching. And like I said, a lot of fun. I'm not in charge of the fun department because I'm not fun. That's what my daughters tell me. But others who are more fun than me are in charge of that. And so we've just been having great rethinks now expanding around the country. And by the way, if you're in the Pacific Northwest in October 2020, is that the right month for that? Yeah, we're having a rethink there. So just be on the alert. It's going to be in Bellingham, I believe, which is just a little east of Seattle proper. But it certainly is in that greater Seattle area. And we're going to draw from people, of course, all over Seattle, Olympia, down in Portland. It's not a long drive to go up there. And so we're really looking forward to our launch there. And as we get closer, of course, we'll give you more information about it. By the way, if you're in the Conejo Valley area, which many of our listeners are, that's a little slice of a valley about 15 miles long. That's west of the San Fernando Valley, the big San Fernando Valley in the Los Angeles area. And this is Ventura County. This is where I live, Thousand Oaks. I'll be speaking there on Wednesday evening, January 22nd, at the Get a Grip series, Living Oaks Church. And you can go to livingoakschurch.org to get the info. If you want to go directly to it, add a slash and get a grip, and you'll get the information about the whole series one night a month. And mostly Stand to Reason folk are doing the presentation. So Tim will be there, Alan will be there, and I'll be there, of course. John will be there. So just encouraging you to be part of that. Starting January 22nd, I launched that event. And I'm also going to be in Sanibel, Florida this coming weekend. That's January 19th, Sunday. I'll be speaking the morning services at Sanibel Christian Forum. That would be it's a Sanibel Christian Forum, but it's Sanibel Community Church. And at SanibelChristianForum.com, that's S-A-N-I-B-E-L, Christian Forum, all one statement, so to speak, .com, you can get all the information about that. I can't remember what I'm teaching on, but I'm doing the Sunday services, then afternoon segment from 2 to 5. And Amy's going to be there? You're going to be in Sanibel? No. Rethink? Oh, Amy's going to be at Get a Grip. Okay, you're going to be helping me out then, right? Okay, so if you want to meet the great Amy Hall, she will be there at the event in Thousand Oaks on January 22nd. Okay, back to what I was talking about, Sanibel Christian Forum. That's January 19th. And actually, my brother is going to be there. He lives a couple hours north, and he's bringing some friends down. And so I'm looking forward to seeing Dave and also the group other Sanibel. So just letting you know about some things coming up. I'll also be in San Antonio the last weekend of the month. So that's like the last day of January, February, 30 days. That's the 31st of January and the 1st at San Antonio. I'll give you more information about that coming up next week. Incidentally, I had mentioned a while back that we're trying to build our following on Instagram to 10,000. And it's not an ego thing for us. When we hit 10,000 followers, that is people who follow, you know, you go there and you follow. That's what they tell me. That's how that works, because I don't know much about that kind of thing. But we move into another tier with Instagram that gives us a lot more latitude, liberties, whatever, privileges, so we can do a better job of reaching you guys and teaching you guys. So we are shy, 151 followers on Instagram to breach the 10,000 mark. So here's all you got to do. If you're not following us on Instagram, go to Instagram and follow us, okay? All we need is 151 more. That's it. And if you don't care about following us, still follow us and then forget about us. We want to hit that number. Now, I don't think you're going to forget about us, obviously, but we want to breach 10,000 followers because that moves us into a different tier where we can be more effective. And just simply put, I got a lot of information here. I don't want to bother you with it right now. I'm just telling you the basic concept. Go there, follow us at Instagram, and then enjoy the benefits that Instagram gives us for breaching 10,000 followers and being able to be more effective at what we do. Okay, with that in mind, briefly now, because we had a lot of callers on the line already, and I'm glad to see that. Thank you. I had an interview this morning with Justin Brierley. Now, Justin Brierley is the host of a very, very popular talk show in London. And so it's called Unbelievable. And if you haven't listened to it yet, it's great to put on your list, because Justin does a fabulous job, and it's always kind of a he said she said, you know, I'm trying to think of the right phrase, but I can't think of it. One view and an opposite view being represented at the same time. Okay, it's adversarial, but it's friendly. And whether it's two Christians with some significant view difference, like on the nature of hell, or whether it's an atheist and a Christian, it's always really interesting. And Justin does really well in that. So shout out for Unbelievable. But we had a short interview this morning. I didn't get home because I've been out of town for the last couple of days with my wife on a special venture, or adventure, I guess I could call it. And we didn't get home until 11:30 last night. I got to get to bed at a little after midnight. Then I had to be up at 5:30 because I had this interview at 8:30 this morning at the office, which is about a two-hour drive from where I live. with Justin, and Justin wanted to talk a little bit about tactics. And so I was glad to do the interview with him and answer his questions for the brief time we had, 10 minutes or so, or no, I guess it was about 20 minutes. In any event, and he's going to be airing that sometime, so if you listen to the show, you'll hear it. But he asked me, there were two different questions that he asked that I thought would be good to pursue briefly here on the show, because there are issues that may come up with you regarding the use of tactics or the people that you're engaged with who aren't interested in talking about Christ. And I wanted to pass on what I told him. And the first one was, given that the title of the book is Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. Some people have been concerned. Skeptics may have raised this who are thinking about what we do, and some Christians certainly have raised it to me, that when you're following a game plan, it sounds a little contrived. It sounds a little canned. You're not really treating people as people. You're not treating them in the kind of the personal way that they deserve, right? And so this, in some people's mind, would be a mark against pursuing something like the tactical game plan for engaging people about your convictions. And there is a plan there. I make no bones about it. There's actually three steps to the plan. Now, if you know the plan, you know what the three steps are, that you're using questions in three different ways in the process of communicating with other people. You're first using questions to gather information about that person or about that person's point of view. Where are they standing in any of these moral, ethical, spiritual kinds of discussions? So you're drawing them out to hear what they think. The second step is to what I call reverse the burden of proof, where you're trying to determine the reasons why they hold the views that they just told you that they held. And then finally, the third way that you use questions is you use questions to make your own point, whether it's your own point of view that you're advancing. There's a way of using questions to get your own point of view on the table that is more tactically effective, makes a bigger difference, easier to maneuver, that kind of thing. And you can also use questions to make the point that there is something wrong with the other person's thinking on a view. Okay? So that's the basic game plan. And there it is in 1, 2, 3. And one of the nice things about the basic game plan is that it's 1, 2, 3. You only have three things to think of, right? To keep track of. And the first thing is the most mild. It's the easiest. You're just drawing people out. You're trying to get their point of view. Now, in the third step, now you're basically maybe telling them they're wrong. But we're doing it in a tactically sound way. But that's advanced. Initially, you're just gathering information, trying to figure out what they think and why they think that. That's the second step. Let me ask you a question, though, given that I just explained that. If you had somebody that was engaging you, that even though you knew they were going to draw you out and ask you questions to find out what you believed, and they were going to draw you out by asking questions about why you believed the things you believe, do you think you'd feel like this was a canned, impersonal enterprise? Well, I guess you could think it's kind of canned in the sense that there's these steps, but it's not impersonal at all when you think about it. To me, this is one of the strengths of the tactical approach. It's not impersonal. It's excessively personal. You're not preaching at somebody. You're just drawing them out, showing an interest in their ideas. There's no preaching at all, on my view, in this approach, because even when you want to make a point, you're going to try to find a way to use a question to accomplish that, or at least to get into your explanation of your own point. And that's soft. That's a soft entry. that's a ramp up into the more controversial stuff. But initially, you're just trying to figure out what that person personally believes and what that person personally thinks are the good reasons they believe what they believe. You see the point I'm making? This is a personal approach. It's not impersonal. It's not treating people as if they're objects or something like that. It's not contrived in a insincere fashion. Look, I remember reading many years ago what really is a wonderful book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It was written probably back, in the 30s or the 40s, Dale Carnegie. It's really magnificent because he is giving a step-by-step approach to do what? To win friends and influence people. So in other words, just because your approach is step-by-step, you have particular objectives in mind that you're trying to accomplish, it doesn't mean that you're annoying people or you're maltreating them or dealing with them in an impersonal way. But in fact, that kind of approach could be winning. And one of the things that Dale Carnegie said to do as a step is to use the other person's name. So I find that, and I recommend this, I think, in the Tactics book, if you notice you're having a conversation with a stranger and things are getting just a little tense, especially if they're getting a little tense, you pause and ask their name. And by the way, what's your name? Fred. Okay, Fred, let me try to answer that. And you begin using their name. Is that a technique? Yeah. Is it contrived? Oh, I guess you could use the word to describe it. But what are you doing with your technique? You're being more personal. You are treating them with more grace. You are softening the environment so they feel that they're being taken more individually seriously. So you can think of techniques that you could employ that are actually winning in the sense that they commend you more to the person with whom you're talking. Nothing wrong with that. So I don't think that this objection, and I'm mostly concerned not with what skeptics raise it, I'm mostly concerned when Christians raise this objection. Because I'm going to ask them if they say, well, that's canned. I say, well, what do? Well, I just talk to people. Really? What do you say? Well, usually I just try to find out a little bit about them. That's the first step. Well, notice that even a person who doesn't want to use a contrived canned approach has a contrived planned approach. They have a first step in mind that gets them going, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think the word contrived is a pejorative, but if all we mean by that is we're trying to plan out our conversation, what could be wrong with that? It certainly doesn't make your conversation impersonal when the plan is to be more personal, to accomplish a more personal conversation to begin with. So I don't think that that's a legitimate concern if that's one of the reasons that you've been uncertain about taking a more measured, tactical, game plan approach to talking with people about Christ. Here's a second question Justin asked me. Actually, we talked about more, but these are the two that stood out I wanted to pass on to you. So I hope you do listen to the broadcast, and unbelievable. He said he's tacking my 20 minutes in at the end of some longer show that he has, just so you know. The second one had to do with dealing with people who are just simply apathetic. You know, they just don't care. And, boy, are there a few people out there like this that don't care about spiritual things, that feel like they have no stake in the matter, it's not a concern to them, especially young people, right? Because they think they're going to live forever. I remember, in the 60s and 70s, I was a fan of Simon and Garfunkel. I still am a fan. So that's not past tense, but I'm speaking of the past tense when, as my favorite, the Bookends album, there's a very sweet song with a tremendous amount of pathos in it about old friends. And it's about growing old as friends. But the darkness of it, this is one thing that they're reflecting on, because they're just in their probably mid to late 20s when they're performing this. Paul Simon, Art Garfunkel. But there's a line there as they're, in a beautifully poetic way, they're talking about the relationship of these old men sitting on a park bench quietly, silently sharing the same fear, which is the fear of death. It's the sunset of their life kind of thing. And there's a line there that really stood out for me. And the line goes, "Can you imagine us years from today sharing a park bench quietly? How terribly strange to be 70. Let's see, February, March, April, May, June. I'm 5 months away from being 70. But the fact is, back then when I was listening to those songs, I was in my early 20s, and I'm thinking, I can't even count that high. It's a long way off. So when you're young, you don't think you're ever going to be 70. And if most people die in their 80s and 90s, then when you're young, you don't think you're ever going to die. It doesn't come up on the radar unless you're a soldier in action. But for the most part, it doesn't come up. And so when it comes to ultimate issues that relate to what happens when you die, it's not on the radar. People aren't thinking about it. So there's lots of apathetic people that you're going to engage, all right, especially young people. So the question was, how do I deal with that? And one thing that I said to him is, in a circumstance like that, preaching at him is out completely. People who don't care certainly do not want to sit through a sermon about something they don't care about, right? And so just kind of trying to engage them and push this religious information in their direction is not going to be helpful. But it seems to me, if you ask them a question, it draws the apathetic person out. See, there's two angles here. One is you talking. The other one is them talking. Apathetic people don't want to listen to you talk. But apathetic people, about people who are apathetic about spiritual things, may be willing to talk with you and share this, their ideas with you, if you ask them. And that's the point here. Because if we ask them, draw them out, ask them some questions about their own convictions, even if they say, "Look, I don't care about spiritual things," what's the next question? "Oh, I don't care about that." What's the next question? Why not? Really? That surprises me a little bit. Why wouldn't you care about ultimate issues like that? Or however you want to phrase it, you want to ask them why. Guess what's going to happen? They're going to tell you why. And what does that mean? That means you're in a conversation with an apathetic person about spiritual things, the things they're apathetic about. But now you're talking. Now, it's not a panacea. It's not going to work with every single person. But it just seems to me that the tactical approach that I advocate, Stand to Reason stands for many, many years. It's a signature characteristic of the Stand to Reason approach of building ambassadors and having them engage. It seems to me that that's probably the best way of dealing or engaging with people who are generally apathetic about these things. They say I don't care much about it. Even if they say that, trying to brush you off. Really, why wouldn't you care about that? Now, maybe they'll tell you one more thing, and that's the end of the conversation, because I don't agree with pushing the conversation, but at least you get another shot. And then maybe they're going to say something that really turns into a more fruitful conversation. And by the way, if you want one question to ask somebody that would be the most direct, soft start entree into a spiritual conversation, here's the one I suggest. And I got this from J. Warner Wallace, and Jim got it from somebody else. And I don't know that person's name, but he does. So when he speaks, he tells the name. I just got to give it to you secondhand. Here's the question. What do you think happens after you die? Or when you die? What do you think happens when you die? It's an open-ended question. And most people have something to say in response to that. And it may be, I haven't the faintest idea. And then I would say, really? Is this something you haven't thought about? No, I don't think about those things. Why not? Notice that there's three exchanges right there. Boom, boom, boom. Three of my questions that lead. Now he's got to respond. But what do we've just built some momentum into a conversation. Now, might it end right there? Sure. But it's a lot better than not doing anything, it seems to me. And if a person says, I don't want to talk about it, I'm going to say, all right. It's all right. I'm not going to push the river. So it turns out that there is something you can do with apathetic people. And by the way, this didn't even come to mind to me. I don't know why it didn't until this morning when I'm talking with Justin Brierley on the recorded section here that he's going to include on his unbelievable show. I get asked this question a lot about people. What about, you know, people who are apathetic? That's a tough nut to crack. I acknowledge that. But it occurred to me when I'm talking with him that the advice I've been giving for years and years and years works great here. Why not ask him a question and see what they say? And here's one question. What do you think happens when you die? Not bad. By the way, you're not committed to going any further when you ask it. You just want to hear what they say. You might not have anything to say to them, but at least you moved another step. Maybe you've just got them thinking about those ultimate issues, those final things, even though they're a young person who thinks they're never going to die. Anyway, that's my suggestion. That's what I told Justin. Offered to his audience there in the UK and actually all around the world, because Unbelievable is a fabulous show, and people all over this country listen. And Justin's been in studio with me right here at our Stand to Reason studios, and he does great work. So I recommend that. But that's the substance, actually in much more detail than I was able to give this morning, that I offered Justin in response to those two questions. All right, let's take a break. Come back in just a moment for your calls on Stand to Reason.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
What does a silo of soybeans or an old 1987 Nissan truck have to do with apologetics? When donated, both enabled STR to provide Christians like you with the resources you need to gain confidence in defending your faith. STR's partnership with iDonate makes donating non-cash items easy. You can give personal items like vehicles, stock, jewelry, gift cards, and more. iDonate takes care of selling the items and gives the cash proceeds to STR. So if you're looking for a unique way to support the work of Stand to Reason, consider donating that random gift card Aunt Bertha gave you last Christmas. Simply go to str.org/donate and click the link at the bottom of the page.
All right, friends, Greg Kogel here, Stand to Reason, and now it's your turn. The number, by the way, 855-243-9975. And, of course, that would be during... My chair's rolling over a cord here. And that's what's going on. That would be during our live show, which is Tuesday evenings from 4 until 6 p.m. Los Angeles time. And on number one for today is Cade in Hibbing, Minnesota. Was it Hibbing, Minnesota, Cade?
Yes, Hibbing.
Cade, you know what? I want to thank you for being so patient, waiting so long last week and never getting on the air.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yes, you're welcome. And I did notice you jumped in first on board here. You got right in the front of the queue. So, Cade, how old are you?
I'm 12.
Wow. Well, I'm so glad to talk to you. If you're in Hibbing, Minnesota, were you in Minneapolis in the early part of November last year when we had our rethink there?
Yes, I was there.
Oh, that's fabulous. Did you like it?
It was very good. It got me very interested in apologetics, more than I've ever have.
Okay, super. So you're a Christian then, is that right?
Yes, I am.
Was that your first exposure to apologetics?
No. My mom has been doing apologetics since college, but a few years ago, she really got into it. And now her and her best friend, they talk about it a lot.
Uh-huh.
And so I've gotten interested in studying it, too.
Super. Well, I'm interested in something. I want to get to your questions, but I have a few more questions for you. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Were you kind of on the sidelines a little bit while your mom's getting into apologetics and kind of watching and you got curious and drawn in? Or was your mom, because of her interest in apologetics and its importance, was she trying to draw you in and teach you and that kind of thing?
You know what? I was probably about 7 or 8 when she first really got into it.
Uh-huh.
And our mom is always pressing on us to serve God first.
Oh, good
for
her.
But she was never really pressing on us that we had to study apologetics yet.
Uh-huh.
But I jumped right in, and I read the whole Case for Christ kids series by Lee Strobel.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
And a few years ago, I attempted to read God's Crime Scene.
You mean the adult version or the kids version?
No, the adult version.
And did you finish it or no?
No, but I did get through a first chapter, and then I kind of got a little out of interest with apologetics for a while.
Uh huh.
But this year, after the Rethink conference, I had been really ripping and roaring, trying to learn as much as I can.
Well, that's really great. I'm very flattered that you'd call the show. And incidentally, God's Crime Scene's a tough book, even for grown-ups. Just saying. So don't feel bad that you didn't get through it. Now, Jim's first book was his first book was Cold Case Christianity, and that might be a little bit more accessible. I don't know. You might be thinking about that.
Yeah, I actually have. I would like to read that book.
Okay, yeah, that's super. All right, well, great. Now that we're good friends, how can I help you today, Cade?
Well, since I'm starting off, I was wondering, I have a list of some books I'd like to read,
uh-huh.
But I was wondering if maybe you have any suggestions, because currently I'm reading 3 books. Your Tactics book.
It's a good place to start.
Stealing from God by Frank Turek.
Uh-huh.
And Is God a Moral Monster by Paul Copan.
Yes, those are all really good books, but they're graduating in difficulty, so the Tactics would be, I think, written in a way that's a little easier. Frank's book is going to be a little tougher. And I think Paul, he's a philosopher. He's an active, practicing philosopher. And so his information is really good, but it's going to be a little bit more academic style. Now, how are you doing with those books? Don't tell me about Tactics. I know you're doing great with Tactics. Okay, but the other, how's Turek and Copan treating you? How you managing their writing?
Well, actually, I'm a very high-level reader.
Oh, really?
When I was about 7 or 8, I read the whole Lord of the Rings and Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh, my goodness. You sound like my 15-year-old daughter. Wow. She's the same way. She's got her own leather-bound copy of the Lord of the Rings, and she's going through it again for the umpteenth time. So good for you. Well, so does that mean that you're navigating those books okay now at 12 years old?
Well, the Paul Copan's book, I am in the 3rd chapter of that, and I'm actually understanding it pretty well.
Uh-huh.
And Frank's book, I actually met Frank and had him sign the book at the the conference.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm currently reading it with my cousins, and we just got done discussing the first chapter. So, yes, all the 3 of the books have been very good.
Okay, great. Well, you are not only reading, but apparently comprehending at a pretty much an adult level, and that's impressive. Are you a homeschooled kid?
Yes, I actually am.
Okay, well, good for you, Kate.
When
somebody asks for recommendations about books and apologetics, there are just so many to choose from that it's just hard to know where to start. And since apologetics is such a broad field, okay? There are books that specialize in different areas. Now, Frank Turek's book, well, both of those books are somewhat specialized, especially Paul Copan's, because he's responding to a certain kind of challenge regarding the Bible that skeptics and atheists bring up. Mm-hmm. So it's a sliver of information. And the same thing is true with, but in a broader sense, with Turek, because he's dealing with how atheists have to presume certain things that are part of our worldview in order to even debate against our worldview, and so they have to steal from God to reject God, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a little thinner slice. But there are other books that are more broad that cover a number of different kinds of arguments. I think that Frank Turek's book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, is a real, if you're reading his, you know, Stealing from God, and you're not having any difficulty with it, I think reading I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist might be a good choice for you.
That was another book that I had him sign at the conference.
Oh, really? So you already have
yes,
that book. Okay.
I plan on reading it. And I, and as I said, I have a lot, I have a good list of books I want to read.
Uh-huh.
But,
well,
like, maybe, like, are there any authors that you might know that maybe, like, might be more, not so well known as maybe you or Turek?
Well, I'll tell you, I have a philosopher friend that's written, his name is Greg Gansel, G-A-N-S-S-L-E. And he wrote a book, he's a philosopher, and so he's written a book about philosophy. But I'm going to tell you, this book is so accessible. It's called Thinking About God. Thinking About God.
Okay.
It's so accessible that I would read a couple of pages out of Thinking About God before I would start working on Tactics, the first time I wrote Tactics, not the new version, but the first one,
mm-hmm.
because I loved his simplicity and his rhythm. It was so friendly and relaxed and accessible. I wanted the same voice, so to speak, to be in my book as well. So if you like Tactics and you're managing that, you'll manage this really well, even though it deals with more sophisticated philosophical concepts.
Okay.
Which are really important to the discussion because it's thinking about God. So it's philosophy of religion stuff, but he covers a lot of the main areas. And he Gansel's a great writer. He does a really nice job. And so I recommend that book all the time to people for its content and its readability. Anybody wants some introduction to the philosophy of religion, get Greg Gansel's book, Thinking
okay.
About God. We sell it here at Stand to Reason, so you can go to our website, but I think you can get it at Amazon as well. And what here's a curious little backstory of this, Cade. When when Tactics 1 came out, the first edition, 10 years ago, Greg Gansel, the same guy who wrote this book, Thinking About God, which I was reading to help me write Tactics stylistically, he reviewed the book, and he
okay.
thought it was great. And so I told him, next time I saw him, I said, by the way, I used your book to help me stylistically in mine, so... you're kind of complimenting yourself when you gave me high marks on Tactics. So it's kind of a good inside joke there. But so that's another one I'd recommend. The other one that this recommendation is not from an unknown, but is a recommendation regarding the most well-known Christian apologists of the 20th century. Got a guess?
It's either Ravi Zacharias or Norman Geisler.
Well, you're thinking a little more. This guy came before both of those guys, but
okay.
they're both are wonderful. I'm talking about C.S. Lewis.
I see.
Yeah, and C.S. Lewis wrote it was published Mere Christianity in 1950. That was the year I was born. So this is a must read. I'm just saying, it's a must read. It is the book that is quoted more than any other apologetics book. I'm speaking anecdotally. I didn't do a survey or anything, but I'm just telling you, nobody is quoted more than C.S. Lewis because he deals with topics not only with a tremendous amount of insight and wisdom, but he is very clever in the way he communicates. He turns a phrase really well. And so that's why he's quoted so much, because he's quotable. Now, one caveat, and that is that even adults nowadays have a hard time with Lewis. That's like, yeah, that's hard reading, you know, which mystifies me, because when Lewis gave the material that you find in what is now called Mere Christianity, he gave it on radio broadcasts in the UK.
Okay.
Which means it was that he was speaking in a popular way to a popular audience, which means it was just basically street talk. You know, everybody could get this. But now just what was basically street talk, in a sense, street conversation, back in the late 40s, early 50s, now, you know, half a century later, people can't get it. So they struggle a little bit. My suspicion is you won't have much difficulty, Cade, with Lewis, just keeping in mind that he uses kind of a British vocabulary sometimes. He says things in a way that Brits would say it than Americans.
Yeah.
But he's magnificent. And I think Lewis is a creature from another planet. And I say that fondly, because he has got so much insight. And there are other books that I've read. I've read a lot of his books. But the kinds of things that he sees or thinks about and the way he explains it are really... He's very singular in his insight and capability. You listen to him or you read him and you say, oh, my gosh, I never thought of it that way, but that's pretty good. So it resonates with our intuition as well. So I recommend that as a top-notch book.
Okay.
Now, one other thing that, you know, I'm just going to suggest, but it may sound a little self-serving. Have you ever read or do you own The Story of Reality?
My mom does, and I actually have it down on my list.
Okay, good. Well, it belongs there, in my humble opinion. And partly because what I wanted to do is to cover a lot of the same kind of ground that Lewis did in Mere Christianity, but in a way that would resonate with more, up-to-date ears, so to speak. And he was actually, in a certain sense, kind of a writing mentor for me when I wrote that book, because the first book I mentioned, Tactics, I listened to Greg Gansel. But when I wrote The Story of Reality, I listened to a British speaker read Mere Christianity. And that just got that rhythm down. And that, I think, made the book more readable. But it's got my language and my words and stuff like that and my organization.
Yeah.
So that's another one. You know what? I'm thinking about a Cade, and I'm wondering, yeah, why did Cade call me about this? This guy's so up to speed, man. He's so in the groove. He's got it, you know?
Well, thank you.
Yeah, well, it seems like you're well on your way.
And then... one more question for you.
Okay.
Is that I was recently listening to a podcast by Turek, and he had Stephen Meyer on the show.
Sure.
And they were talking about theistic evolution.
Right.
I wasn't catching everything they're saying, so I thought I'd bring it up now. So what is exactly theistic evolution, and why is it wrong?
Well, there's a couple of things I could say, but I'm going to kind of try to keep it as general as possible.
I understand.
You know what Darwinian evolution, the idea, the general concept of the Darwinian evolutionary explanation for the development of life over time.
Isn't it macroevolution too?
Well, it's like microevolution added up over a long time to make macroevolution, right?
I see.
And it often includes the idea that there's a common ancestor, they call it universal common descent, UCD, and that from the first form of life, other forms of life developed, and there were mutations in the genes. Now, this is the new version. Darwin didn't know anything about genes, so this is called neo-Darwinism.
I see.
There's mutations in the genes, and then natural selection works on the mutation to select that change in the organism that is most suited for survival. And because you have mutations creating variations and natural selection choosing the best one, this is what moves biological development over long periods of time. Okay, so that's Darwinian evolution. Now, something that's really important about understanding this, and again, I'm just giving you the bare bones of Darwinian evolution, also called the neo-Darwinian synthesis. So it's genetic mutation plus natural selection equals biological development over long periods of time. So you get this incredible diversity of life that we have on the planet. And the large, overwhelming majority of scientists believe this view. Okay, I'm just saying. Now, the reason that this view, and one other detail, on this view, and when you read these scientists who believe in it, there is almost unanimous voice on this, that this is not directed. It is not guided in any way. It is a completely blind process. It's not going anywhere on purpose.
And that's what the atheists believe.
That's the atheistic or even non-atheists. People might have some religious convictions, but when it comes to evolution, it's happening all on its own. Okay, so that's the basic idea. I'm not saying aye or nay to the idea right now. I'm just trying to explain in fairly simple terms what the concept is.
Okay.
So it's change over time because there's changes in the genes that result in changes in the critter, something about their bodies are different. And some of those changes mean the critter is better able to survive. So natural selection weeds out the less capable ones. And the new development in the body in the critter now becomes more prominent until there's another genetic mutation that changes some other feature of the body. And that is weeded out. The good ones are weeded out from the bad ones or vice versa by natural selection. And eventually you get all of these magnificent creatures that are very complicated because of these little bitty changes over long periods of time. The little micro changes end up with a macro result. So you're right in that terminology. Now here's the question. Does it make sense then to say that God used this process that I just described to you? And so that would be theistic evolution. Theistic, God does exist, but the evolutionary idea that the atheists believe in is actually true. They're just missing out on the God part.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a couple of problems with it, okay? Here's the first problem. I don't think that the Darwinian project itself is sound. I'm leaving God out of the picture right now.
Okay.
I'm not talking as a Christian. I'm not talking as a theist. I'm just looking at the evidence. And this is, I know Steve, I've known Stephen Meyer for 30 years. And I know that this is the point that he's making. That when you look at the evidence all by itself, the evidence does not support, the scientific evidence does not support that view. And he focuses in very tightly on a particular part of the problem. There's a number of them. But one particular part has to do with information, because it takes information to build something, kind of like computer code. You probably made that reference.
Yeah.
And you've got to make computer code and have computer code to get the computer to do what computers do. But code doesn't happen by accident. Any code, zeros and ones by accident, isn't going to make anything do anything.
Mm-mm.
You need an intelligent individual in order to write the code that makes things happen. But you see, now you've got something happening where there's a goal in mind and a purpose. It's not just going wherever by accident. Pardon me?
Fine-tuning?
Well, fine-tuning would be a little bit different notion. Fine-tuning is evidence of a designer, but it's that deals with a different arena, more like the universe, et cetera, and the solar system, et cetera. But the same concept is applied just to the genetic structure of the cell. Can you get the information on the genes, which, you know, has to be mutated and changed to get new qualities that are chosen by natural selection. Does that work? And what Stephen Meyer says is, no, it doesn't work that way. We know enough about it to know it doesn't work. So one problem with theistic evolution is the evolution side. If evolution is not true, if it didn't happen that way, then why attach God to the project? Okay?
Yeah.
That's you know what the Titanic was, right?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's like, as somebody would say, polishing the brass on the Titanic. We're going to repaint this ship because but even though it's going to sink tomorrow, we're going to paint it, you know. The ship is sinking. Why are you painting it, you know? Abandon ship. And so that's the point there. So one problem with theistic evolution, I mean, this would be my assessment, is that I don't think the evolution part is sound. So there's no reason to marry it together. But there's also another problem. If you're saying theistic evolution, then you're saying God used the evolutionary process. But the evolutionary process is not directed by definition.
Meyer talked about that a lot.
Yeah. So it's you know, you've got a directed, non-directed process, and that's a contradiction.
Exactly.
Yeah. So now, obviously, I'm offering a fairly straightforward, simple, abbreviated approach, and people listening who believe in theistic evolution, they'd have a lot to say about the way that what I offered, as they do to Stephen Meyer. But my point is I think I'm giving you an overview, and I think even people who complain and say, well, you didn't take this into consideration or this and thing, I think there's the answers to those things too. Biblically speaking, I don't think you're going to find room in the biblical narrative, and I don't mean just Genesis chapter 1. That's not even what I'm referring to. I'm referring to other passages, like in Romans chapter 5, where it talks about Adam sinning. Look, if Darwinism is true in the sense we're discussing it, and it explains the development of human beings from earlier primates, you know what I mean by that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then where's Adam fit in? Where is Adam?
Yeah, why isn't he still evolving?
Well, it would be so much, at this point, it's a theological question. Because in order for the New Testament, the Bible account of salvation, to make any sense, you have to have a real Adam who is morally innocent, never did anything wrong, Adam and Eve. And then they fell and became sinners and infected, in a certain sense, the rest of the human race. And that's why we're all in trouble. But if evolution is true, then how could there be any real Adam that God created as a unique being?
Yeah, because then it would all evolve to Adam.
Yeah, evolved to Adam, exactly. And evolved from from different sources, from a much broader population. So then where's Adam? And if there's no Adam, then there's no fall. And if there's no fall, then what's the point of Christianity? Because Christianity was meant to fix the fall, right? The effects of the fall. So you see, the theology is kind of connected to the beginning. And if you change the beginning, the theology that follows afterwards, like Jesus being the Son of God who came to earth to die for all human beings who are all sinners in order to rescue some of them, well, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
We could only be all sinners as if our first dad sinned and passed that down in some sense to the rest of humanity, which is the biblical account.
Yeah.
So I'm not, I have never been a fan of theistic evolution. And I think that it's problematic on two fronts. And one of them is you can't tie the theism to the evolution. It's not coherent. I mean, it's a contradiction. It's a guided, unguided process.
Yeah, they just don't fit.
They don't fit. There is a conflict, I think, with the Darwinian model and the biblical story or biblical account. You know, nothing downstream from Genesis makes any sense if Genesis is if the the detail of the of a real Adam and Eve, who are the parents of all humanity, fell from innocence by sinning against God and creating a whole race of fallen people. That makes no sense.
Yeah, exactly.
And then on the other side, I don't think the Darwinian model is true anyway.
I think
it fails on its own merits as a scientific explanation for biological development. And so it's in my way of thinking, it's doubly dead. All righty.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Kokel.
Well, Cade, you know, I gave you like half an hour here, and that's because, for one, you've asked some really good questions, and for two, you are really a lot of fun to talk to.
Well, thank you, Mr. Kokel. That means a lot coming from you.
Well, good. And, it's also a compliment to your parents. And so I'm tipping my hat to them, too. I don't know if they're listening in right now, but they can catch the whole thing on the podcast if they need to. But it's just it's great talking to you, Kate. I'm glad you came to the Rethink. And I imagine next year is this year, isn't it? That's right. We're in 2020. So later this year in November, I don't know what the exact dates are, but it's pretty close to the other one. Maybe I'll see you there at Rethink. What do you think?
I think we're going.
That's good. Are you bringing some friends?
Last time I went with my friend.
Oh, okay. So you had a group already?
Yes, my cousins and my best friend.
How big was your group?
There was my mom, my friend's mom, my grandma, and my two cousins.
That makes six by my count. I bet you there's more than six coming up next time around.
I think so.
Okay. Well, Cade, once again, thank you so much for the call and for the pleasant conversation. You are a very clear communicator. You're very polite, and all of this is going to commend you well, and it's going to serve you well the rest of your life. All right?
Well, thank you, Mr. Kokel. Have a great week.
Yeah, you too, Cade. Thanks so much for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Man, that was sweet. Oh, what a great way to end an hour. Oh. Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give him heaven this week. Bye-bye now.